Welcome to this episode of Out of the Best Books, the podcast where we deep dive into classic literature and have conversations about what we've learned and discovered along the way. We love all things books and reading, and we want to share our love of the classics with you. We hope to inspire you to read along with us and join in the conversation. I'm Laura.
And I'm Amity. Let's get started. On to part two of Anna Marie Newell's. This delightful and hilarious and relatable and just such a fun book. So much. How much do I say that with the books that we're reading, though? I love it so much.
Yeah, but this one is like, this is one of my top, like, of all time. And reading it is just like coming home. I don't know. It was like my childhood. It's just so familiar and so beautiful. Earlier this year when I was reading Rebecca, I felt like her writing was so beautiful. Like everything just was amazing. And somebody said they thought it was kind of over the top, like too much. Oh. But that's how I feel about this book too, is like every sentence is like so well crafted.
And it really is.
So well thought out and just clever. And I just love it.
And then everything that Anne says is, you're just like, we love Anne, but I'm pretty sure I said this last episode, but what about Lucy Maud Montgomery? The fact that she created this character, we've talked before about how authors will talk about how they learn from their characters. Like their characters sort of take them on a journey, you know? So maybe that's how this was for Lucy Maud Montgomery. She's like, Anne sort of came to life. I don't know, but oh my gosh, she's amazing.
Yeah. So. As much as we love Anne, it's like, well, Lucy Maud Montgomery created her. And she is Anne because who she is.
Yeah. You can't create this kind of a character unless that is happening in your brain somewhere. So I don't know.
Yeah. It makes me wonder if she was somebody who's kind of like this.
Mm-hmm.
Kind of a lot, kind of over the top, kind of eccentric. I don't know. Yeah, she'd have to maybe. Be a little bit.
I feel like she'd have to be.
It's so good. So let's jump in with chapter 11. I have the first one. So Anne's impressions of Sunday school. I love her. So, and I'm going to try to make these fast. And I think
yeah.
I did. So
we'll do that. Yeah.
Because we have a lot. So in this chapter, Marilla makes Anne three new dresses, but of course, none of them have puffed sleeves. That's like the only thing she wants out of life is a dress with puffed sleeves. I don't really remember understanding that everybody else had puffed sleeves.
Mm-hmm.
So she's the only one that just, you know, and Marilla is just too straight-laced. I don't know, too practical. That's the word, too practical to indulge in this. But so Anne doesn't think that the dresses are very pretty. Marilla says, I didn't trouble my head about getting pretty dresses for you. I don't believe in pampering vanity, and I'll tell you that right off. A lot of the stuff Marilla says in this section just cracks me up. I laughed out loud a couple of times. This day, Marilla has a headache, and so she sends Anne to Rachel Lynde's so that she can go to Sunday school. Anne stops on the way to Sunday school and she decorates her hair with wind-stirred buttercups and wild roses. She's taking her little time. And so she misses Mrs. Lynde and she has to go on to Sunday school all by herself. None of the other girls, like, so she hasn't been to school yet. So this is like her first introduction to the kids in Avonlea. Mm-hmm. So none of them are very friendly to her. They'd all heard about her, but they're just not very friendly. But Anne doesn't really like the Sunday school teacher. And then she's also upset that she's the only one not wearing puffed sleeves. She said, Anne felt that life was really not worth living without puffed sleeves. When you're a kid, have you ever think that? Like, if I can't have this
there's
one
something
thing,
just so important to you that you would die if you didn't have it.
Yes. It just, yes. I believe she comes home and she's talking to Marilla about this. Marilla is always just like, you shouldn't have done that, Anne. That's not how we do things, right? Constantly. And she says to her, you shouldn't have been thinking about your sleeves in Sunday school. You should have been attending to the lesson. I hope you knew it. So Marilla asks about Sunday school. I thought this was funny because they used the words opening exercises, which is mm-hmm. something we don't hear very much. But during opening exercises, she had stared out the window and imagined things the whole time. And She said it was too hard to imagine puffed sleeves because I didn't have them and everybody else did. But see, the text was too long, the sermon was too long, and Mr. Bell's prayers seemed distant, which is a really good for her because her prayers are so personal and deep and personal that she's like, his prayers sounded like he wasn't talking to anybody real, basically. She said, Marilla, this is what it says about Marilla. Marilla felt helplessly that all this should be sternly reproved, but she was hampered by the undeniable fact that some of the things Anne had said, especially about the minister's sermons and Mr. Bell's prayers, were what she herself had really thought deep down in her heart for years, but she'd never given expression to. It almost seemed to her that those secret, unuttered, critical thoughts had suddenly taken visible and accusing shape and form in the person of this outspoken morsel of neglected human. Listen to that paragraph.
So I know, it's so good. Also, it makes me think about, don't we need people in our lives every once in a while that say what everybody's thinking, that where everyone else has a filter and then we're like, we shouldn't say that out loud. And they're just like, just say it. But really, I guess that's really what comedians are too, isn't it? Like they're the unfiltered brain, the mouth that will say the things everybody's thinking, but nobody dares to say. And that's Anne.
Well, that's true. Yeah, Marilla's like, I've thought this for a long time, but I've never said it out loud. And she's exactly right.
Yeah. And maybe she's even like squashed her thoughts and been like, oh, I shouldn't think that. I'm sure it's me. It's probably just that I'm not appreciating it. But then as soon as she hears somebody else give voice to that, she's like, yeah, that's true.
We went to church. I went to church with my dad for just me and him once, like this last Sunday, which I've never done before. It was
Wow. Yeah.
But he was staying with us for the weekend and he came home and he told somebody, that was the most boring church I've ever been to. He told David that. And I go, you can't hear a word they're saying. So I'm not sure how you think it's boring, but
might not be a fair judge sitting there not hearing anything.
We're sitting in the back and he can't hear anything they're saying. Anyways, and I was like, hey, that was really actually pretty good. Chapter 12 is a solemn vow and promise. So Marilla had heard from Mrs. Lynde about the flowers in Anne's hair at Sunday school. Anne cries and says, maybe they should just send me back to the asylum. And Marilla says, nonsense. I don't want to send you back to the asylum, I'm sure. All I want is that you should behave like other little girls and not make yourself ridiculous for putting these flowers in her hair. You know, she's like, Anne says it's something about the colors. And she's like, becoming fiddlesticks. It was putting flowers on your hat at all, no matter what color they were. That was ridiculous. You are a most aggravating child. No, the most aggravating child.
The most aggravating child.
Kids always make fun of me because I use the word ridiculous too much. I'm like, this is ridiculous. Guys are ridiculous.
That's a good word, though.
So like she said is, I don't want to send you back to the asylum. I just want you to not make yourself ridiculous. And then Marilla invites Anne to come along with her to meet this girl that she's been told about that lives down, you know, kind of, I think she just lives across the Lake of Shining Waters or something, about Diana Barry. She wants to go meet Diana Barry. And she's like, you don't need to impress Diana, but you need to impress her mom because she's a star.
Yeah.
And so when she's introduced to Mrs. Barry, Mrs. Barry says, how are you? And she says, I'm well in body, although considerably rumpled up in spirit. Thank you, ma'am. Then aside to Marilla in an audible whisper, she says, there wasn't anything startling in that, was there, Marilla? What a child to like meet for the first time. And so she's like, was that okay?
Yeah.
You okay? Mrs. Barry thinks it's going to be great for Diana to have a friend because her nose is constantly in a book. Diana's excited to have a friend that is close enough to play with. And so they kind of run off together and immediately Anne brings up the idea of like, do you think we could be bosom friends? This is when the girls make this oath. Anne says, will you swear to be my friend forever and ever? And Diana looks shocked. Why, it's dreadfully wicked to swear, she said. Oh, no, not my kind of swearing. There are two kinds, you know. I never heard of but one kind, said Diana. There really is another. Oh, it isn't wicked at all. It just means vowing and promising solemnly. So I just thought that was funny. Like, Anne just has this view of the world and like so much more knowledge than in any of the other kids her age. You know. And then on the walk home, then Marilla asks Anne if Diana is a kindred spirit. And Anne then goes into like all the plans that they have for her. Oh, this is what Marilla says to her after this huge long list of all the plans that they've made together. Well, all I hope is you won't talk Diana to death. You're not going to play all the time, nor most of it. You'll have your work to do and it'll have to be done first. So like Marilla, and I wrote this later in the book, she never lets her have a moment without this like a cut or like a rebuke or like instructions or a teaching. Never.
Yeah.
Like, okay, that's great. She's a kindred spirit, but you just keep in mind, like things aren't going to be just as you want them all the time.
Yes. Which I don't think is very effective parenting or training or anything. It's not, because kids will, it just puts kids on their guard to where they're like, well, I can't share anything with you because you're just going to try to constantly be teaching. And kids don't learn a lot from words like that anyway. But if you remember, like in the beginning, first few chapters, Marilla, she just like felt like she needed to, like that's what she needed to do, is always insert a moral, always insert some sort of training or teaching. And it's like, loosen up, my friend.
And she's consistent with it.
Yeah.
She does it.
Yeah.
And I love the end of the chapter. Matthew brings her some chocolates and says she's going to share half of them with Diana. And Marilla does say this. I will say it for the child. She isn't stingy.
Yeah.
I'm glad for all the faults. I detest stinginess in a child. Dear me, it's only 3 weeks since she came, and it seems as if she's been here always. I can't imagine the place without her. Now, don't be looking. I told you so, Matthew. That's bad enough in a woman, but it isn't to be endured in a man. I'm perfectly willing to own up that I'm glad I consented to keep that child, and I'm getting fond of her. But don't you rub it in, Matthew Cuthbert.
She's so funny. Yeah, but that's what I love, too, is that you're slowly seeing Marilla soften up and learn what it is to be a parent figure to this little girl. And she really is throwing herself into learning about Anne and appreciating her and all of her quirkiness. Anne certainly throws some curveballs. So,
yes. And one thing I wanted to say real quick is that like that chapter 11 and 12 both ended with Marilla giving like kind of a final, I don't know, like a good Marilla paragraph at the end.
Yeah, that's true.
Look for that and see if it keeps up.
Yeah, seriously. All right. 13 is called The Delights of Anticipation. So Marilla looks out one day. She sees Anne talking to Matthew on the fence. She's like, she needs to be in here doing her sewing. But she observes that Matthew is completely infatuated. He loves Anne. And she says, the more she talks and the odder things she says, the more he's delighted, evidently. They're told about a Sunday school picnic. Okay. And Anne is so excited. She can't even begin to imagine how wonderful this is going to be. And so she's like, Marilla, can I go? Can I possibly go? You know, she's like, I would do anything to go. And Marilla's like, well, yeah, you can go. You're in Sunday school. You can go to the picnic. You know, all these things that are everyone else just takes for granted. They're so big for little Anne. And hopefully that helps us to really understand and realize and sympathize with her, you know, the background that she comes from. Anne is very concerned because she's like, well, everybody else is going to have a special basket of baked goods. And I don't know how to bake, but maybe we could figure something out. And Marilla's like, I will bake you a basket. She's like, I will take care of it, you know? And again, I think Anne is pretty shocked, but she's so shocked that she goes in and she gives Marilla a little kiss on the cheek. And this is so sweet because it says it was the first time in her whole life that childish lips had voluntarily touched Marilla's face. She was secretly vastly pleased at Anne's impulsive caresses. But again, it's almost like she feels like she has to reprimand her or teach her something. So she says, there, there, never mind your kissing nonsense. I'd sooner see you doing strictly as you're told. I've been waiting to see if you'd sober down a little and learn to be steady before I begin teaching you how to cook, all these things. Anyways, she acts like the kiss on the cheek was an annoyance. She actually loved it. And is there anything better? Cass is like getting into this phase where he'll reach up and he'll put his little arms around my neck, pull me down and kiss my cheek. And I'm melted. I just melted all over the floor. That's
where enjoy I am. It, right?
I know. Totally. Oh, it's so sweet. Those little toddler lips.
Yeah, I think Marilla is like afraid of feeling. And so she has
yes.
to jump right into this, like, well, don't get used to this, or, you know.
Yes, exactly. And it's Well, this will be a classic example one right here in a second. Anyway, Anne cannot stop talking about her and Diana's adventures and all she's looking forward to with the picnic. She's so excited because she's going to taste ice cream for the first time. She tells about all the things they're going to do. There's going to be boats at the lake and all these kids and all these fun things. And it says she talked picnic, she thought picnic, she dreamed picnic. And this is what Marilla says. She says, "You set your heart too much on things, Anne. I'm afraid there will be a great many disappointments in store for you through life." Which I had to underline and had to write next to it because I was like, Marilla doesn't understand where Anne is coming from yet. Marilla still has a lot to learn. Anne is coming from disappointment after disappointment after disappointment after disappointment. She's had more hard things and more disappointments in her 11-year-old, like 11 to 12 years of life, than probably Marilla has ever known.
Yeah.
And they're pretty extreme and pretty traumatic. And so it's like, no, the fact that Anne has already gone through this and she still has this bright, shining hope, that is not to be squashed. That's not to, there's no room to say, well, you're going to be so disappointed in life. It's like, or not, because yeah, do hard things happen? Of course. But Anne's attitude is always to look on the bright side, to look for the good things. And shouldn't that be what we are doing even when we're disappointed? And you see her doing this constantly. And I love what Anne says. She says, "Looking forward to things is half the pleasure of them. You mayn't get the things themselves. So the good thing may not even happen, but nothing can prevent you from having the fun of looking forward to them." Mrs. Lynde says, "Blessed are they who expect nothing, for they shall not be disappointed. But I think it would be worse to expect nothing than to be disappointed." And so she always has these high hopes because for her, the joy is in the hoping. Is that interesting?
Yeah, they say that like vacation, the best part of vacation is looking forward to it. It's not actually going on the vacation.
Yeah, it's really true. I mean, okay, it kind of depends on the vacation a little bit. But yeah, no, it's really true because sometimes you find yourself in the midst of a vacation. You're like, okay, I feel like this should be fun, but it's not. It's not quite what I envisioned. I've certainly had plenty that were just like better than I could have imagined. But
or the whole time you're on vacation, you're like, this is going to end. This is going to end. This is going to end.
For sure. That is true too. Anyway, at the end of the chapter, we're introduced to this special brooch that Marilla has. It was given to her by her mother. In fact, it has a lock of braided hair from her mother around it. Okay. That to me is kind of odd, but it was very much a thing before now. I don't know when it stopped being a thing, but it's not really anymore. We don't go around with brooches pinned to us that have our dead forebears' hair wrapped around them. Anyways, but hers did, and it had some beautiful amethysts surrounding it. And Marilla, this was like a prize brooch for Marilla. She loved it. So in chapter 14, the confession, Marilla is missing this brooch. And she goes to Anne and she says, "Have you seen my brooch?" Anne says, "Yes, I saw it this afternoon when you were away at the Aid Society." Marilla says, "Did you touch it?" "Yes." And Marilla's like, "It is very wrong of you to do that. You should not have touched it. You shouldn't have been in my room. You shouldn't have touched my brooch." And she's like, "What did you do with it?" Anne says, "Well, I put it right back." Marilla is like, "You didn't put it back." "I did." "You didn't." "You did." "I did." Yeah, back and forth. But Marilla is like, "Okay, well, I'll go have another look." She looks everywhere. She looks behind her bureau, which is like a dresser. She looks up and down and all over and every nook and cranny. She doesn't find it anywhere. And finally, she's like, "Anne is lying to me. Like, it is nowhere. And I've looked everywhere." She finally says, "I believe you were telling me a falsehood, Anne." And she's so devastated by it because there's an innocent look on Anne's face. And so it's like, Anne, to her, it's like Anne can lie without even slightly looking guilty. And that is terrifying. It's terrifying. You're like, what did I do to my child if they can lie to me like that?
We were playing a game last night that Presley was teaching us, and it was hilarious. It was called like, "Has the like somebody in the middle of the dog and who has the bone." And
okay.
She thought it was, we were all laughing hysterically. It was like both sets of grandparents and all of her adult siblings playing. And we were laughing hysterically at this game. And she kept saying, "This game isn't funny. Stop laughing." Like, I don't, you know, she did not understand. Like, she's like, "This is a serious game." And what it was you were supposed to, like, this is who has the bone. And then somebody, whoever has the bone, is supposed to like disguise their voice and say, "I have the bone." But with our family, it was super obvious who was speaking, even though they were trying to.
Yeah.
Voice. So we tried it. This one time where nobody said anything. We just looked at their faces to see who had the bone. And I was the dog. And so I looked at Charlie and I was like, "Oh, Charlie has it." He has no poker face. I just thought, well, I don't think he ever lied to me because I would know.
Yeah.
It was really funny last night. Like, we were dying.
That is super fun. Oh my gosh, I love it.
Rosie's like, "This game is serious. I do not understand why you're all laughing."
Nothing funny here.
Yes.
She probably was worried that you were laughing at her or something.
She did think that, and she's really sensitive to that. But we're like, "We're not laughing at you. We're laughing at the inability of us to play this game."
Oh. Okay, so Marilla, like, in her heart, she's like, "I don't suppose she meant to steal it or anything like that. I suppose she has lost it and is afraid to own up for fear she'll be punished." She tells the story to Matthew, and Matthew is also like, "What? Like, this doesn't seem in character for Anne at all." But it's one of those things, that, like, the evidence is staring you in the face. You can't deny it, you know? And neither of them want to believe that she's lying. But it's like, but she is, like, there's no other explanation. And Matthew, he wants no part of it. He's like, "Well, I guess you're going to have to punish her, but I'm not putting my oar in, as they say. I have nothing to do with it." So Marilla is like, "I don't really know what to do." Anne keeps refusing to confess. So she's like, "You're staying in your room until you decide to confess, even if that means that you miss the Sunday school picnic." Anne is absolutely horrified. She's like, "Can't I just come out for the picnic? I've totally had some of my kids like try to deal with me like that." And I'm like,
"No."
So no. If you just stayed in your room and then you came out for all the fun things, then like that would just be like living normal because you play in your room all the time. And anyway, Anne calls Marilla up and she is like, "Okay, I'm ready to confess." She tells this whole lavish story about how she was pretending that she was Lady Cordelia Fitzgerald. And she decided that she needed this amethyst brooch. And so she walked out to the Lake of Shining Waters. And it says, "And then when I was leaning over the bridge, it just slipped through my fingers and went down, 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 all purpley sparkling, and sank forevermore beneath the Lake of Shining Waters. And that's the best I can do at confessing, Marilla." And I think that she really thinks that as long as she confesses something, that Marilla's going to be like, "All right, you can go to the Lake of Shining Waters." Instead, this makes Marilla furious. And Anne is really like, "Okay, I can go now, right?" And Marilla's like, "No, no, you're not going anywhere. Basically, you're staying in that room for eternity."
I think it's unfair because basically she said, "You're staying in that room until you confess." So yeah. Anne's like, "Okay, well, I just need to confess and then I'm done."
Right, right.
You know, she didn't, I mean, in her confession, she's not like, "I stole it." She's like, "Oh, I was just playing with it and I just happened to lose it and I'm sorry." Yeah. I don't know.
Yeah. Maybe. Yeah. I think that probably was her line of thinking, but Marilla is just infuriated. So Anne comes down for lunch. They eat. She's just so teary-eyed and sad. Marilla decides that she needs to fix. She saw a little tear in one of her shawls in her room. So she goes in, picks up the shawl so that she can fix it. And there is her amethyst brooch hanging on the shawl. And she remembers that she'd come back from like the Ladies Aid Society meeting or something, laid that shawl on her bureau for a minute. And she's like, "It must have gotten caught on it then." And then she'd put it down in her chest. And there it was. And then she's upset about Anne's confession. Because she's like, she confessed to something she didn't do. Why'd she make up that whole story? So she talks to her about it. And Anne's like, "Well, you didn't believe me. You said you'd keep me here until I confessed. So I decided to confess because I was bound to get to the picnic." What it immediately makes me think, I mean, it makes me think of a lot of things. There's a lot of people who are coerced into confessing things they never did. all the time. It totally made me think of the Salem witch trials. Like the people who were forced to confess that they were witches, even though they had nothing to do with it, but it was to save their lives. Like, you confess to being a witch and we won't hang you. We're just going to banish you. Or you sign this paper saying that you confess to being a witch. We're going to hang it up. And you turn in a couple of other witches and then you're going to be fine, you know? So people like turn their backs on who they are, what they are, everything they believe in, just to save themselves. Which, I mean, okay, I haven't been in those shoes before. Honestly, hanging and death by fire are like my two biggest fears. So I might confess to anything to avoid those. Like, fair enough. Anyway,
yeah, but like, it's just in this situation, did they spare their lives? Or were they hung anyways?
Oh, for witches?
Yeah.
I think it just depended a lot of times. It seemed like for the most part, if they did confess to being a witch, they would let them go. They would usually be banished.
Okay.
It did just depend. But most people were not going to confess to being witches because they're like, but I'm not a witch.
Right.
And it was like, the truth will set me free. Except when you're living in crazy town, the truth is not going to set you free.
Right.
It'll just get you killed. Going along with what you observed before, this chapter ends with Marilla reflecting. She says, I've learned a lesson. I have to laugh when I think of Anne's confession, although I suppose I shouldn't, for it really was a falsehood, but it doesn't seem as bad as the other would have been somehow. And anyhow, I'm responsible for it. That child is hard to understand in some respects, but I believe she'll turn out all right yet. And there's one thing certain, no house will ever be dull that she's in.
Yeah, so is each chapter like Marilla learning a lesson from Anne?
Well, the last chapter, sorry, or chapter 13 is Anne talking to Marilla about amethysts. But
yeah, it's just so
not every chapter, but it does happen a lot, doesn't it?
The end of the chapter, she's like, what would I have done without her? How could we live without her? Like, I'm starting to love her, basically.
Yeah. Yeah.
So chapter 15, A Tempest in the School Teapot. Anne starts school. Her and Diana, when they walk to school, they walk the pretty way. So they don't want to go down the boring old road, but they go the pretty way. They go down Lover's Lane, which is a hilarious name that they've given it. Willowmere, Violet Vale. And then I love that Diana named one of the places Birch Path. And Anne's like, I could have done better, but she wanted to name something, so I let her. Poor Diana is me, and she's trying to have an imagination, and it's not going well. It just cracks me up. So Marilla was very worried about sending Anne to school because she's worried about how she's going to get along with the other kids and how she's ever going to hold her tongue during school. Like, this child is never going to be able to sit and listen. But it actually goes pretty well. She does pretty good at school. Anne, though, does come home complaining about the teacher who's constantly flirting with Prissy Andrews. And Marilla's like, hey, you're not going to come home and complain about the teacher. Like, just stop that right now. This isn't going to happen again. Poor Anne is, I mean, in the whole classroom is just like, oh, the teacher and Prissy Andrews. Like,
yeah. We have to note that Prissy Andrews is 16.
Yes.
And the teacher must be in his 20s. Just a different time. That was not abnormal.
They're all googly eyes.
Yeah. And so that's why Marilla is not, she's not appalled by that behavior.
Right.
She doesn't want Anne to speak badly of the teacher because it's not illegal for a teacher to go after a 16-year-old at that point in time. We are grateful for laws now that protect teenagers, for sure.
Yes. And well, I always picture the teacher in the movie and I'm like, ew, he was gross.
I know, seriously. Oh, geez.
Like this snivelly little man. Anyway.
Yeah, seriously.
Yes. So we learn that Anne is just a little bit behind the other kids at school because she hasn't gone to school as much. But she tells Marilla about all the nice things that the kids are doing for her at school. And that she gets her first compliment ever. And I love this. Jane Andrews told me that Minnie McPherson told her that she heard Prissy Andrews tell Sarah Gillis that I had a very pretty nose. Marilla, that is the first compliment I ever had in my life. and you can't imagine what a strange feeling it gave me. Marilla, have I really a pretty nose? I know you'll tell me the truth. What do you think Marilla says, right? Your nose is well enough. But secretly, she thought Anne's nose was a remarkably pretty one, but she had no intention of telling her so.
Yeah.
That's really cute. Anyways, yeah, she can't give her any kind of compliments. So this is the great chapter where we're introduced to Gilbert Blythe, who is like the crush of all whatever generation I am. Gen Z, I think. Anyways, all of us that grew up in the 80s watching this show, just like Gilbert Blythe.
We just looked through to see what all the different generations were. You know, there's the greatest generation, which is World War II. Well, it's like 1920 to whatever. So everybody that fought in World War II. Then there's the baby boomers. And then there's, I think we're millennials.
I'm not. I'm the very end of what's before millennials.
Oh, okay.
Millennials were born between 1981 and 96. So
okay.
I was born in 79. Gen Z is after that.
Yeah, Gen Z would be after that. Do you mean, so what is up to seven? It seems like there's a pretty short period of time that's another one, because it's like the baby boomers and then another generation.
Okay. Oops.
Even though each generation is supposed to be like 20 years.
The kids are Gen
Z. Gen X.
Yeah, Gen X.
Yeah.
Yes.
You're
okay.
Gen X.
There we go.
And millennials.
So
then
Gen
Gen
X,
Z.
That's me. You're a millennial. And then our kids are Gen Z. Most
right.
of them. So every all
most
my
of them.
kids except
But
Presley.
Then because then you get into the later, the 2015s and whatever. And then what is that one? I heard it recently.
Just says the last one it says is Gen Z is till 2012. Why wouldn't it tell us? That's weird. Yeah. I don't know. It's so confusing. Anyways, so if you were
I know, it's funny.
A Gen, what did I say? I'm a Gen X.
You're
yeah,
a Gen X.
You're a Gen X or a millennial, then you're in love with Gilbert Blythe. There, that's the
yes.
Okay, so this is what we find out about him. He teases the girls. His name is written up on the porch wall with Julia Bell. He is also very smart, but he is behind too, because his father had been sick, and so they had left and he had not gone to school. And you also find out that he's older than them. He's 14. They're like 11, 12-ish, so he is older. So we find out also, let's see. Oh, I love this. Anne sighed. She didn't want her name written up, but it was a little humiliating to know that there was no danger of it. She doesn't really want her name written up on the wall, but she's also a little sad that nobody's ever going to like her. And so we also find out that Anne might have a little bit of competition. And Anne says about that, I'm glad. I couldn't really feel proud of keeping ahead of little boys and girls just 9 or 10. So she's glad that he's older and in her group. I got up yesterday spelling ebullition, maybe. Josie Pye was head, and mind you, she peeped in her book. Mr. Phillips didn't see her. He was looking at Prissy Andrews, but I did. I just swept her a look of freezing scorn, and she got as red as a beet and spelled it wrong after all. I thought that was really cute. So at the beginning, Gilbert plays a trick on Ruby Gillis, and he ties her braid to the seat, and then when she stands up, it like yanks her back down. And then he winks at Anne. Diana's been like talking Gilbert up. Like, she either has a crush on him or all the girls.
Oh, she totally does. All the girls have a crush on him. Yes. Yeah.
And so Anne says to her, I think your Gilbert Blythe is handsome, but I think he's very bold. It isn't good manners to wink at a strange girl. So cute. Morning goes okay. She's like, okay, he's handsome, whatever. But in the afternoon, Gilbert is desperately trying to get Anne's attention, but she's totally oblivious. And he's not used to this, because normally the girls give him their attention. So here's what he does. Gilbert reaches across the aisle, picks up the end of Anne's long red braid, held it at arm's length, and said in a piercing whisper, carrots, carrots. Then Anne looked at him with a vengeance. She did more than look. She sprang to her feet, her bright fancies fallen into clueless ruin. She flashed one indignant glance at Gilbert from eyes whose angry sparkle was swiftly quenched in equally angry tears. You mean, hateful boy, she exclaimed passionately. How dare you? And then thwack. Anne had brought her slate down on Gilbert's head and cracked it. Slate, not head, clear across. He did the worst thing ever. Calling her carrots was like,
yeah.
She then gets in trouble. So Mr. Phillips comes back to investigate. Gilbert admits that he had teased her, but Mr. Phillips doesn't even listen to him. He's just like, I can't believe a student of mine would act like that. And I loved this sentence too. He says, I'm sorry to see a pupil of mine displaying such a temper and such a vindictive spirit. And then the text says this. He said in a solemn tone, as if the mere fact of being a pupil of his ought to root out all evil passions from the hearts of small, imperfect mortals. I can't believe a student of mine would act like that. That's going to make
student
a difference.
Of yours? What is special about you, dude, yeah, other than you've got a crush on the teenage girl?
Right? What have you done here? So her punishment is that she has to stand at the front of the room with Anne Shirley has a very bad temper written above her. She never looks at Gilbert the whole afternoon. And then after school, Gilbert comes up to her and tries to apologize. And this is a word I love that she says when she's talking to Diana. Gilbert Blythe has hurt my feelings excruciatingly, Diana. She's so dramatic. Then when all of the kids come back from lunch late, all of them, the teacher only chooses Anne to punish. And her punishment, of course, is that she has to sit next to Gilbert. The poor girl. So she goes to sit by him, but basically she just keeps her head down the whole day. Gilbert slips her a pink candy heart that says, you are sweet. And she drops it on the floor and smashes it with her shoe into a powder.
I love it. Like, I really do, because I don't know. I just admire that. I think if we all had the gumption to be like, no, you can't make up to me just by giving me a piece of candy. I am not that dumb or lame or cheap.
But she's trying.
No.
He's got it for her.
He is trying.
Yes.
She's going to make him try really hard.
So after school, she cleans out everything in her desk and she's like, I am never coming back. This is it. I'm done. That afternoon, when she tells Marilla that she's not going back to school, Marilla then goes and asks Mrs. Lynde for advice about what she should do. And of course, Mrs. Lynde has already heard about the incident. She thought that the teacher was in the wrong. She says, just let Anne be. She'll change her mind eventually. You just let her get through this. At the very end, the chapter ends with Anne worried about Diana getting married someday and leaving her alone. This is I think of this kind of stuff, like worrying about things way in the future. Like, I used to worry that, yeah, I would never get married. Like, nobody would love me and I would never have children because.
I have to just quickly insert a story here because it made me think of it when I was reading. So my mom always tells a story about when she was like 5 years old, they were sitting at the dinner table and she was number five of six kids. And they were all sitting at the dinner table and she just burst into tears out of nowhere, just burst into tears. And her mom was like, what's the matter? You know what's going on? She's like, I'm already 5 years old and I don't even have furniture for when I'm married. Oh my gosh, I love it. I'm just like, the brains of children are just incredible. I love them.
Yeah,
so
they worry about the most ridiculous things. I did too. I was just,
they all do. But it was like, I was talking to my sister the other day and like, for a child, life is big and huge and scary and unknown. It is a battle. It's a battlefield for them because there's so much that's out of their control. They're so incredibly vulnerable and they do worry about things. Yeah. As adults, we look at it and we're like, well, you don't need to worry about that. We only say that because we have the experience to understand that it's not worth worrying about. But for a child, unless they do have an adult who is guiding them and loving them and protecting them, it's scary, man. It's scary even for the ones that do have a loving, guiding, protecting adult, you know?
Scared. I have a hard time with my kids and their fears, but I'm like, their fears are real.
Oh yeah.
Okay, so chapter 16, Diana is invited to tea with tragic results. I love this chapter. And my favorite Anne quote of all times comes from this chapter when she says, I'm so glad I live in a world where there are
yes.
Oh,
so much.
My favorite sentence. It would be terrible if we just skipped from September to November, wouldn't it? Look at these maple branches. Don't they give you a thrill? Several thrills. I'm going to decorate my room with them. And Marilla is like, you clutter up your room entirely too much with out-of-door stuff. Anne, bedrooms were made to sleep in. She's so practical.
There's Marilla's philosophy for everything.
Yes, I love it. Marilla tells Anne that she's going to a meeting in Carmody, and so she's going to be responsible for tea and supper. And then the last time she was in charge, she totally forgot to like start the tea until it was dinner time. And so Matthew had to wait forever for the tea, and he didn't care. But she's like, can I invite Diana over for tea? And then I won't have to worry because I'll be so excited. I'll make sure I get it all ready. Anyway, so she says, yes, you can invite her. And she kind of tells her about all the things that they can have. Like there's some fruitcake and there's some cookies and there's this raspberry cordial that's in the pantry on the second shelf that you can have. And it was like a drink that was left over from like a church picnic or something, or social, church social, but they're able to have. And so Diana comes to tea and they start out so formal, asking each other questions that they really already know the answers to. Like, how is your family? How is your mom? Anne tells her what she is serving, even though that's like not appropriate for her to tell her guests what she's going to serve, but she can't stop it. So then they go out to the orchard to spend the afternoon. And I was thinking about this, like this chapter made me realize how opposite her life is now from what it was before.
Oh, yeah.
She's going out into the orchard to enjoy the afternoon with her friend and then serving her all this wonderful food in the house. You know, like, it's just so opposite.
Absolutely.
So Diana's telling her all about the gossip from school because she's not going to school right now. And she brings up Gilbert. So that's when Anne jumps up and says, okay, we need to go in. It's time to go in. We're not talking about Gilbert, right? Basically. And so they're going to go in and have this raspberry cordial. And at first, Anne can't find it. But then she thinks she finds it at the back of the pantry. And so Anne, of course, tells Diana to have as much as she wants. You're my guest. You have as much as you want. So Diana drinks three large tumblerfuls of this raspberry cordial. Anne goes into this big, long story about, I love this story too, about how the mouse had drowned in the pudding sauce that she had forgotten to cover. And like they had guests at dinner and they were like about ready to eat the pudding sauce. And she's like, there was a drowned mouse in it. She tells that big long story. Then she looks at Diana and she's like, what's the matter? She's been talking endlessly for a few minutes. Diana then is dizzy and she keeps saying she needs to go home. She just kept saying, I just need to go home. I just need to go home. There's something very wrong with her. So Anne walks her partway there. And then when Anne runs home, she cries all the way home because she's so upset that like her afternoon tea is ending like this. Then on Monday, Anne goes to Mrs. Lynn's on an errand and finds out what had happened, that Diana had come home drunk on Saturday. And Mrs. Barry says Diana will never play with her again. Of course, Anne swears, like, I only gave her raspberry cordial. And what had happened is Marilla had put, like, she'd taken the cordial down to the cellar instead of put it in the pantry. What was actually in the pantry was, what was it? Alcohol, some kind of alcohol. Currant wine. There you go.
Yes.
Marilla had, like, not, she hadn't made currant wine for years because, like, the minister didn't approve of it. But she had this, like, half of a bottle or something that was she was going to use for medicine. And everybody in the town, or a lot of people in the town, had like looked down on her for making it. So she'd stopped making it. It's not Anne's fault at all. You know, and Marilla's like, well, didn't you taste it? Like, can't you tell the difference? And she's like, no, I didn't taste it.
I don't think that she'd ever tasted any of them. And so I think she says that she wouldn't have known even if she had.
Right. And would think that Diana would have known, but the whole time Diana's like, this is the best raspberry cordial I've ever had.
Yeah. And it's funny too, because Marilla's like, well, even three tumblerfuls of the raspberry cordial probably would have made her sick. That was so much for her to drink.
So Marilla goes over to the Berries to explain the situation, and it doesn't go well. Mrs. Barry doesn't believe her, basically. I love what Marilla says. I should think she would better punish Diana for being so greedy as to drink three glassfuls of anything. Why three? Yeah, that's what you just said. Why three of those big glasses would have made her sick if it had only been cordial. Anne then goes and tries to explain. It also doesn't go well. But I love what Marilla says. And Marilla's like on her side. Oh, well, yeah, of course she it is. Was her fault, but you know, she says, Mrs. Barry, indeed, of all the unreasonable women I ever saw, she's the worst. I told her it was all a mistake and you weren't to blame, but she just simply didn't believe me. And she rubbed it well in about my current wine and how I'd always said it couldn't have the least effect on anybody. I just told her plainly that current wine wasn't meant to be drunk three tumblerfuls at a time. And that if a child I had to do with was so greedy, I'd sober her up with a right good spanking. Okay, so this is when Anne then goes over and tries to talk to her also. Says this speech, which would have softened good Mrs. Lynn's heart in a twinkling, had no effect on Mrs. Barry except to irritate her still more. She was suspicious of Anne's big words and dramatic gestures and imagined that the child was making fun of her. That's it. She just, it doesn't go well. I love what Marilla says at the end. I do not believe about Mrs. Barry. She says, I do not believe that God himself can do very much with such an obstinate person as Mrs. Barry.
Yeah, because she's like, I don't think there's any point in praying because it's not going to have any effect. Fair enough. I will say I've maybe had that feeling one or two times.
And it's just so hard. These kind of situations like the brooch and the alcohol and stuff, they just don't believe her.
And it's really hard because so much of it is just her orphanhood, this bias that they have, whether they realize it or not. But that is really what it comes down to. It's like, well, she's this orphan, so more than likely that she tried to get Diana drunk, that she did take the amethyst, you know? It's just really sweet. At the very end of chapter 16, Marilla goes to check on Anne and she finds that Anne had cried herself to sleep. And she says, so this one does end with Marilla again. Poor little soul, she murmured, lifting a loose curl of hair from the child's tear-stained face. Then she bent down and kissed the flushed cheek on the pillow. She had never been kissed by a child before. And I don't think that she had ever kissed a child before on the cheek. And she did. So we really do see this growth and this change, this evolution. And it's just the best. Chapter 17, A New Interest in Life. The next day, Anne looks out and there's Diana. She's waiting for her. She's like, come out here. So Anne rushes out. She's like, has your mother like forgiven me, basically, you know? And Diana's like, no, I have exactly 10 minutes, like 10 minutes from the time that she left her house to talk to Anne, to basically say goodbye forever. You know, she's like, my mom is never going to let me play with you again. It's funny, but it's also, it's so sweet. This like, we're always going to be friends as long as the, what is it? They promise that they will never forget each other and they trade locks of hair and they, Anne is very dramatic. She says, fare thee well, my beloved friend. Henceforth, we must be as strangers, though living side by side, but my heart will ever be faithful to thee. I'm sorry. It's so funny. Anyway, and she's so angry. Not angry. She's just, she is. She's very upset with Mrs. Barry. And she's like, I'm going to die of a broken heart and then Mrs. Barry will be sad. And Marilla's like, I don't think there's much fear of your dying of grief as long as you can talk, Anne. But the one good thing that comes out of it is something good always comes out of rough things. Anne goes and gathers up all of her things and she says, I'm going back to school. I have nothing else to live for because I don't have my best friend. So I'm going to school. She, first of all, she's welcomed back with open arms. Everybody is glad that she's back, which is so sweet and very gratifying for Anne to be like, oh, people do like me. And this is amazing. And she and Diana do trade little notes back and forth because like Diana won't even look at her. And Diana's like, my mom said that I can't look at you. I can't talk to you. I can't interact with you at all. And you know, Mrs. Barry's the kind of person who has like spies everywhere. She just seems like that kind of person. The other thing is, though, that now Anne just dives headfirst into her schoolwork. She pushes herself so hard, but she has quite the, I believe it would be an extrinsic motivator. And that is Gilbert. Gilbert and Anne push each other to be their very best. Mostly it's because they don't want the other to beat them. And so if Gilbert gets a high score on the test at the end of 1 month, Anne gets the high score the next month, and then Gilbert the next month, and Anne the next. And she's always studying so hard, working so hard to keep improving so that he can't be ahead of her, but they go back and forth, so they keep pushing each other. The one bane of her existence is geometry. She does have a hard time with that. Chapter 18, called Anne to the Rescue. So Marilla and a bunch of the ladies and men in the town, they go to see the premier, who I thought was similar to like the prime minister, maybe that's who it is. They are quite into politics. Marilla and Matthew are both conservatives. Rachel Lynde is a liberal. But isn't that such a good lesson? They're like best friends. They don't ever think about what side of the aisle they're on until it's like time to talk politics. And even then, it doesn't matter. It's just the way they vote. So they think differently. They can still be friends. So Marilla leaves with several others, and they're going to be overnight somewhere to see this premiere. So Anne and Matthew are at home. They're studying. It's a cold winter night. I believe it's January. And all of a sudden, Diana bursts in and she's like, I need help. You know, little Minnie Mae, her little sister, she's got the croup and it's so scary. She's like, the babysitter doesn't know what to do. Mom and dad are gone. Matthew immediately goes to hook up the horses and go to find the doctor. And Anne is like, I love what she said. She's like, he's going to Carmody to find the doctor. I know he doesn't even have to say anything. I know because we're kindred spirits. And Anne is like, also, I know exactly what to do. I didn't take care of three sets of twins for nothing. They often had croup, so I know exactly what to do. So she goes with Diana. She jumps right in. She's like, Mary Jo, who's the babysitter, heat some water right now and get me the syrup of Ipecac. So they administer the syrup of Ipecac. They're there pretty much through the night administering syrup of Ipecac, getting the steaming water, and they save her life. The doctors were nowhere to be had. Like, they didn't get there till the next morning. And they even said, we would have been too late. Anne sat and she told the doctors exactly what she'd done. And they were like, she saved this baby's life. Like, absolutely. They were very impressed with her. Like I said, that went through the night. So she goes home with Matthew. She crashes out. She's like, I can't miss school because then I won't be ahead of Gil. But, well, she doesn't want to say Gilbert. She says everybody else. But
I love it. The whole book. Gil. Oh, no, everybody else.
Like, yeah. Yeah. It's so funny. She doesn't want to say his name, but she does anyway. So she sleeps through half the day. And when she comes down, Marilla is there. And she is like, you need to eat something. And then, just so you know, Mrs. Barry has been over here and she's singing your praises. She wants you to come over there and races out the door. And of course, they've just like forgiven her, and not just forgiven her, they ask her forgiveness. They're like, we know you didn't mean to get Diana drunk and you saved our baby's life and we owe you the world. And if you ever need anything, you know, and come over here whenever you want to, you and Diana can spend all your time together, whatever. So it's good. Marilla is kind of like, okay, that seems a little over the top, but I love it because at the end, Anne is like, I assure you, Marilla, that I feel like praying tonight and I'm going to think out a special brand new prayer in honor of the occasion.
In one of the chapters, she's at school. Well, there's an apple on her desk and she picks it up and she starts eating it. And then she's like, wait a second. The only orchard that grows these kinds of apples is the Blythe's orchard. And so she like immediately drops it and dropped the apple as if it were a red hot coal and ostentatiously wiped her fingers on her handkerchief. Like,
she's such a turd.
Yes, she's like, I'm having nothing to do with him or anything he's touched or any, you know. I think he might have left it for her. So,
oh, I think that he did.
Yeah. So yeah, she's like, I'm not taking this bait. I think in the book you don't. Not in the book. In the movie, you don't really get that he, well, maybe you do. But I think you really get it in the book that like those little things aren't in the movie where he's like offering her candy and
yeah,
the apple and trying to get her attention. It's more like teasing her.
Super quick. Have any of your kids have had croup before?
Yes.
Isn't it the worst? Like actually? I remember watching Anne of Green Gables. And seeing little Minnie Mae with the croup and just going, I hope that's not a thing because I don't think I could handle it if my kids had croup. None of my siblings that I knew of ever had croup. Maybe they did, but I sure don't remember it. Five of my kids have struggled with croup.
All of them.
Yeah. Audrey was the only one who didn't. For some reason in Oregon, we never had a problem. So it's interesting that you guys did.
Oh, yeah.
It was like we moved to Oregon and just the humidity or something. My kids are fine. As soon as we moved back here, Cass got horrible croup several times in a row. But
what's annoying is that Presley thinks if she's sick, if she wakes up in the middle of the night, and now it's now during the day, if she's sick, she thinks she needs to take a bath because she'd wake up with croup in the middle of the night and we put her in the bathtub.
Yeah.
And so
a bath makes everything better anyway. So, I mean, fair enough.
Yeah, but we are doing sometimes like several baths in a day.
Ooh.
You, and it, like 2 in the morning when she's like, I need a bath. And we're like,
Yeah, you're like, no.
walk in the morning.
Nope.
She had one Saturday night. She woke up Friday night because her birthday was Saturday. She woke up in the night gagging like she was going to puke. And so
I had to
put her in the bathtub because that's what she.
Yeah.
2 o'clock in the morning. All right.
Oh my gosh.
But she's at the age now where we just run the bath and then I go lay down and then she yells at me when she's ready to get up.
Yeah, that's very nice.
I'm like, I'm going back to bed.
Yeah.
But yes, croup. All of my kids have had it. And you're like, you can take them outside, you can put them in the bathtub, or you can go back and forth.
Yeah, we usually go back. Well, we do, like, we'll put water on the stove, get it to a boil, so there's tons of steam. And then they just, I just stand with them over that. So they're like breathing in the steam and go outside in the cold air.
It's just such a
We've had to do steroids. We've had to do a lot of steroids,
oh.
Breathing treatments and stuff. It's bad.
Yeah, Charlie had to do breathing treatments when he was a baby. He was really sick until he was about one, and like a lot. And then he never was sick again. But it's like a scary, scary cough.
Oh, it's terrifying.
And it scares them to death.
Yeah. Well, it totally does. At least with my kids, they're usually getting enough oxygen, but they're working really, really hard for it. And I think that's what's so scary is like how hard they have to work to breathe. And then they've got this terrifying cough that sounds like a seal. And
I know. Well, she has the barking cough again.
Yeah. Oh.
But luckily, they don't die from it. So that's
no.
Good. Okay. So, chapter 19, a concert, a catastrophe, and a confession. So, I love that the girls have come up with this signal that they give each other from their windows with cardboard and candles. Diana has signaled to Anne that she needs to come over right away. And I also love that, like, when she tells Marilla, because Marilla's like, well, how do you know that you're supposed to go visit her right now? Like, this doesn't make any sense. And she tells her, and she's like, you're going to burn the house down. But she's like, go ahead, go, you can go. So Anne runs over there and finds out that Diana's mom had said that tomorrow is Diana's birthday and that she could go home with her after school and stay the night. And that Diana's cousins were coming, and they were coming from this in a sleigh, and they were going to go to this debating club concert at the hall tomorrow night. And so they want to take Diana and her to the concert. She says, if you'll let me go, that is. Of course, Marilla thinks that this is ridiculous. Anne's like, I'm sure the debating club is like kind of a respectable thing. Like, what is the problem here? And she's like, I'm not saying it isn't, but you're not going to begin gadding about to concerts and staying out all hours of the night. After Anne goes to bed that night, Matthew says to Marilla, I think you ought to let Anne go. That's all he says. Even when Marilla argues back and gives her reasons, Matthew just keeps saying it. He's like, he says it several times, even the next morning. I think he says it a couple times that night. He says it the next morning. He's like, I think you ought to let Anne go. So Marilla does finally decide that she can go, but she says, this is Matthew's doing, and I wash my hands of it. If you catch pneumonia sleeping in a strange bed or coming out of that hot hall in the middle of the night, don't blame me, blame Matthew.
Oh, all the things she worries about. It's so funny.
I know, it's like catching pneumonia. Okay, all right, Marilla. At school the next day, Anne can't concentrate on her lessons. Gilbert beats her in everything that day. And it's all anybody at the school is talking about. They're all going, except this one little girl whose father agrees with Marilla, and she doesn't get to go. But everybody else is going. So after school, they go back to Diana's and they get ready. Anne is jealous because Diana has this really fancy fur coat, and Anne just doesn't have anything fancy because her caretaker is Marilla. They do end up going to the concert in this big sleigh. The concert's amazing. She even laughs when she shouldn't. And like everybody around her kind of laughs to like make her feel better because they laugh with her out of sympathy. That night at home, Diana says that she can't believe. Oh, when Gilbert gives his little monologue or whatever, he reads his thing. She like picks up somebody's book and like reads it and won't even look at him. And so they go home, and Diana's like, I can't even believe that you didn't listen to him. He'd even been looking right at her when he was reading his part. Anyway, she just picked up this book and read it, and says she sat rigidly stiff and motionless. And Diana claps her hands until they tingled. They're all in love with him. So cute. I love what Anne says. Diana, you are my bosom friend, but I cannot allow even you to speak to me of that person. Then here's her problem. Are you ready for bed? Let's have a race and see who gets to the bed first. So their race to the bed finds that old Aunt Josephine is in it, which is hilarious because she's 70 and my parents are 70 and they do not seem this ancient. So
yes,
I don't know if this is a different time or if they were like older.
I mean, to be fair, like if you lived to be 70 at that point in time, like
you were old.
You were pretty old. Yeah. You'd outlived a lot of people.
This Aunt Josephine is so prim and proper. So they run and jump on the bed and she freaks out and they freak out because they're not expecting to be in bed. But Diana, after they leave and they have to go sleep with Minnie Mae, which I'm like, that doesn't make any sense. Why don't they just go back to Aunt, I don't know, Diana's bed? Like, where would they have slept sleeping in the spare room? Diana just knows that Aunt Josephine's going to be so mad. So the next morning, she's not at breakfast and Mrs. Barry said that it's everybody else's fault all the time. I was going to stay up and tell you guys that she was in the bed, but like I was tired, so I just went to sleep. So sorry. That would have been good information to have, right?
Yeah.
So Anne just goes home. And later that day, Mrs. Lynde comes and tells Anne how mad Aunt Josephine was. That originally she was going to pay for Diana's music lessons. And she's like, yeah, I'm not paying for those anymore. And I'm going home now. I was going to stay a month, but what she's like, this is ridiculous. So,
which is so funny because if you think about it, like put yourself in her shoes. Okay. I also don't like being awakened in the middle of the night, but like I can't even imagine reacting like that.
No.
That's wild to me.
I'm not paying for your music lessons. I'm going home right now. I can't believe I was treated this way. You know.
Like, I'm sorry. That is so witchy.
Yes.
That is so dramatic. And
Anne is worried that because not only does she get in trouble, but she also gets all of her friends in trouble all the time too. Mrs. Lynde, I think, says, you must learn to think a little, Anne. That's what. The proverb you need to go by is look before you leap. Especially into spare room beds. And I forgot to mention that they're super excited that they're going to get to sleep in the spare room. Like, this is a big deal. And even Anne says to Marilla, like, imagine it, your little orphan Anne sleeping in a spare bedroom. Anne feels so bad about it. And so she decides to go back and talk to Aunt Josephine. And this conversation goes very well. Aunt Josephine is like enchanted by her and decides that she is going to stay the whole month. And the reason she's going to stay is because she wants to get to know that Anne girl. Oh, so cute. Anne decides that Miss Barry, is a kindred spirit underneath it all. She might not seem like it at first, but deep down, she's a kindred spirit. Later on, they become really good friends.
Yeah, she's a very special person in Anne's life for sure. And very influential in lots of good ways, so.
And then the last chapter, A Good Imagination Gone Wrong. So it's been a year since Anne has come to Green Gables. This passage that I'm about to read, like, kind of gives you an idea of how things have changed for her in that year. It says, in all essential respects, the little gable chamber was unchanged. The walls were as white, the pincushion as hard, the stairs as stiffly and yellowy upright as ever. Yet the whole character of the room was altered. It was full of a new, vital, pulsing personality that seemed to pervade it and to be quite independent of schoolgirl books and dresses and ribbons, and even of the cracked blue jug full of apple blossoms on the table. It was as if all the dreams, sleeping and waking, of its vivid occupant had taken a visible, although immaterial, form and had tapestried the bare room with splendid filmy tissues of rainbow and moonshine. Just like everything at Green Gables is the same, but nothing is the same.
Yeah.
Totally feels different. I loved that paragraph. So Anne asks Marilla if she regrets her staying. And she says, no, I can't say I'm sorry. And then it says, said Marilla, who sometimes wondered how she could have lived before Anne came to Green Gables. No, I'm not exactly sorry. And then she just, if you finish your lessons, Anne, I want you to run over and ask Mrs. Barry if she'll lend me Diana's apron pattern. She won't ever have her, let her have a moment. Just like, yeah, I'm not sorry, but we're not going to talk about that right now. Let's just go do your errands. So Marilla basically wants Anne to run over to the Barrys to get Diana's apron pattern. Anne claims that it's, oh, I love this chapter. Anne claims that it's too dark and that she's going to go in the morning. She's like, I'll get up first thing, like sunrise, and I will go get it. So they go back and forth. until it comes out that Anne and Diana had imagined the haunted woods. And their imaginings are hysterical.
They really are.
Yes. So Marilla says, "What has gotten into your head now, Anne Shirley?" And she's like, "Well, I'll have to go around by the road then." Like, she's not going to go through she says, "I can't go through the haunted wood." She's like, "Marilla, the haunted wood? Are you crazy? What under the canopy is the haunted wood?" And she's like, "The spruce wood over the brook." "Fiddlesticks. There's no such thing as a haunted wood anywhere. Who's been telling you such stuff?" And then it comes out that they had imagined this whole haunted wood. And oh my gosh, there's a white lady walks along the brook just about this time of night and wrings her hands and utters wailing cries. She appears when there is to be a death in the family, and the ghost of a little murdered child, that's awful, haunts the corner up by Idlewood. It creeps up behind you and lays its cold fingers on your hands. And anyway, she just goes on, and it is hysterical. Marilla asks her, like, "Do you actually believe all of this?" And she's like, "Well, not in the daytime, but after dark, it's different." And then she tells Marilla all about these people that she knows that have actually seen ghosts. So, like, all these people that are respectable in the community, she's like, "They've all seen ghosts, so they must be real." Marilla says, "No, you are going over there." She says, "You'll go right over to Barry's and you'll go through that spruce grove just for a lesson and a warning to you. And never let me hear a word out of your head about haunted woods again." I love this too. She says she marched the shrinking ghost seer. I love that seer. Down to the spring and ordered her to proceed straightway over the bridge and into the dusky retreats of wailing ladies and headless specters beyond. And then Anne's like, "How can you be so cruel? What would you feel if a white thing did snatch me up and carry me off?" Now, this is, I think, one of the funniest lines of the whole book. She's like, "I'll risk it."
I know. And that's when you're like, all right, Marilla, you're catching on to this whole parenting thing.
She's like, "You know I mean what I say, and I'm going to cure you of imagining ghosts into places. March now." The storytelling and, like, the wording in this chapter is just brilliant.
Yeah.
She says, Anne never forgot that walk. Bitterly did she repent the license she had given to her imagination. The goblins of her fancy lurked in every shadow about her, reaching out their cold, fleshless hands to grasp the terrified small girl who had called them into being. A white strip of birch bark blowing up from the hollow over the brown floor of the grove made her heart stand still. The long-drawn wail of two old boughs rubbing against each other brought out the perspiration in beads on her forehead. The swoop of bats in the darkness over her was as the wings of unearthly creatures. And then on the way back, she says, Anne went back over it with shut eyes, preferring to take the risk of dashing her brains out among the boughs to that of seeing a white thing. It's like, I'll go with my eyes closed.
You can totally see her too. Just, oh my gosh. So dramatic.
I love this book. I just
take the risk of dashing her brains out among the boughs that is seeing a white thing. Oh, and you have to read the last couple of lines there.
Yeah, she says, "Well, so nothing caught you?" said Marilla unsympathetically. "Oh, Marilla," chattered Anne, "all but contented with commonplaces after this."
And maybe control her imagination a little bit.
Oh, I loved that chapter. I loved it.
So funny.
Oh,
wow. Okay, we did it.
So next week we'll do 21 through 30.
Do you have a book to share?
I do. Okay, so I was going to my mom's. Sometimes on Tuesdays I go to my mom, like every 8 weeks or so, I go to my mom's and stay the night. And she happened to have book club. So it was Tuesday morning and I was like, I didn't have anything to read. I hadn't picked something yet. And she's like, "Oh, I forgot to tell you book club's tonight." And I was like, "Oh, what are you reading? I guess I could read that." So I listened to it all day. And
that's amazing.
I almost finished it. I had like an hour left when I got to the book club. But
yeah,
it was called The Immortal Life of Henrietta Lacks. Have you heard of that?
Oh, I feel like I have heard of that.
By Rebecca something. I had to buy it on Audible because, you know.
Okay.
Because when you need a book right now.
Yeah.
By Rebecca Skloot. And this is a book. This is a movie that you can watch. Oprah's in it. Oh. I don't know. I don't remember where you can watch it. But so it's about Henrietta Lacks, who was this lady in 1951. She was about 30 years old. And she got cervical cancer and died really fast. But they scraped some of the cells off of her cervix, and she was the first person that they've ever been able to keep cells alive. And so, like, the doctor that took these cells, like, was giving them away to, like, all these research people without the family knowing. I mean, they weren't selling them, but they were, like, distributing,
just giving them,
because they were multiplying so well. And so people are still using her cells today to study stuff. And her cells were, like, instrumental in, like, the HPV vaccine, the polio vaccine, I think HIV, like, studies, tons of stuff.
That is wild.
The problem is the kids, her family, they were done without her knowledge, and none of the family knew about it. And they didn't know that her cells were, like, being passed out like this. And so that's kind of what the book is about, is, like, them finding out and, like, them not understanding what was going on. Cause they were, like, her husband was her first cousin. And so the kids were kind of, they had problems.
Oh dear.
Yeah. Anyways, like, they were all deaf, not deaf, but hard of hearing. And, like, they had some other problems, but so it was very good. It's a little bit of science and story, science and story. So, like, if you like that kind of thing, science was a little, like, confusing for me, but I liked the story part and it was fascinating. So
that's really cool. Wow. Interesting.
It was good.
I know I've heard that title, and maybe I've, like, stumbled across the previews, but I know I've never watched them because
the lady that wrote the book became really close with the family. And so that was really interesting.
Yeah, that's cool. That's cool.
I loved it. So
I don't have anything to share because I'm lame and feel like I'm drowning. I am reading Anne of Green Gables, and I am still my 800-page certified personal training book. But I will be starting to, like, just finished a couple books with my kids. I've already talked about them, so I won't talk about them again. But it took us a while to get through them. They were kind of, like, heavier topic books. But tomorrow I will be starting a couple new ones. So by the end of this week, even if I don't get to start my own. And I've put so many books on hold too, or tried to find so many books. I was like, this would be so nice to listen to when my brain just needs a break. And I can't find any. Or they're all, like, 7 months out. So the struggle is real.
My next book that's coming up on Libby is, like, 7 or 8 weeks, which probably it'll show up way faster than that.
I mean, yeah, they usually do. But
actually, now it's 4 weeks. So, yeah.
Oh,
and then it just went to 3 when I opened it.
Ooh. Oh, look at that. I know that made me just go, I should look and see.
It switched from 4 to 3, like, while I had it open. So anyways, yeah, 3 weeks, and then my next one's 5 weeks, and then 8 weeks. So I don't know.
Oh, I've got about 10 weeks, about 21 weeks, several months, several months, several months.
My son is working for me now for a few months till probably when he goes to school in August. And so now I'm not in the car, so I'm worried that I'm not going to be able to read as much. But
I bet you'll find ways.
I'll figure it out.
Because really, like, yeah, just while you're doing dishes, while you're cleaning, while you're folding laundry, like, all those things, or just going on a walk.
Yeah, I
need Heck, to. I have to do it when I'm just driving to the store.
Yeah. Yeah, I need to do that.
We're so happy you joined us for this episode. We hope you will join us next week as we discuss Anne of Green Gables by L.M. Montgomery, chapters 21 through 30. If you have suggestions for books we should read and discuss, please email us at thebestbookspodcast@gmail.com. We would love it if you would leave a review wherever you listen to podcasts and share our podcast with your friends. We want to inspire and encourage as many people as we can to read out of the best books.
As Thoreau says, read the best books first, or you may not have a chance to read them at all. See you next week.